Welcome to the Negro Leagues, Our Major Leagues podcast, a production of Sports Reference. I'm your host, Curtis Harris, and today we're joined by Adrian Burgos. He is a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, specializing in U.S. Latino history, as well as sport, urban, and African-American history. Professor Burgos is well-credentialed for today's discussion on Negro League baseball, and I think you will enjoy what he has to say. But first, let's put across some of these credentials. Professor Burgos' first book, Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Color Line, analyzed the incorporation of players from the Spanish-speaking Americas into U.S. professional baseball to illuminate the working of baseball's color line. His second book, Cuban Star, How One Negro League Owner Changed the Face of Baseball, took Burgos' interest in race and baseball integration further by exploring what it means to be black and brown in the United States through the life of Alejandro Alex Pompez, an Afro-Cuban American who went from Negro League team owner and Harlem numbers king to a major league scout that opened the Dominican talent pipeline. Burgos also co-hosts the podcast Say It Ain't Contagious, and his scholarship on Latinos in baseball has led to collaborating as an academic advisor on museum exhibits such as the National Baseball Hall of Fame's Viva Baseball and the Smithsonian's Play Ball, which is scheduled to open in October of 2021, and has a companion book co-authored by Burgos with Margaret Salazar Porzio. In our conversation today with Professor Burgos, we discuss how African and Latino players navigated the world of Jim Crow to create an often overlooked but fascinating history of allyship between black and brown baseball. All right. This is Curtis Harris for the Negro Leagues, Our Major Leagues podcast. And today we're joined by Professor Adrian Burgos, a professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign campus, the main campus for the university. I've already given like a professional introduction for Adrian, but I'd like him actually to introduce himself to you all. I always think that's interesting to hear how folks describe themselves. So Professor Burgos, could you tell the audience in your own words who you are and what you do?
Absolutely. And thanks for having me on. I'm Adrian Burgos Jr. I'm a professor of history at the University of Illinois. I teach Latino history. I teach sport history, urban history, and African-American history. And my research has been focused on the presence of Latinos in U.S. professional baseball. And one of the ways I did that history a bit differently was to really emphasize the importance of Latinos in the Negro Leagues. That is, how did that participation shape the possibilities of playing professional baseball in the United States for Latinos? And then just as significantly, how was the interactions between African-Americans and Afro-Latinos and other Latinos in the Negro Leagues a template for thinking about how the color line worked in U.S. professional baseball? So my first book, Playing America's Game, really tells that story of Latinos as one story. Other books have kind of given a nod to like, oh yeah, Latinos playing in the Negro Leagues, but let's talk about the handful of guys who were playing in the major leagues before Jackie Robinson. Let's talk about the majority of Latinos, whether they were light-skinned or Afro-Latino, played in the Negro Leagues as their pathway into MLB. And that is where we can really understand how the story of Latinos and African-Americans were very much intertwined. Rube Foster was like the first guy to like really weave these things together. Every time Rube Foster tried to create a league before he finally launched the Negro National League with the collaboration of African-American, Latino, and white American owners, he always included a team called the Cuban Stars. And that goes as far back as 1908. And when I saw the incorporation papers for the league that he tried to start based out of Chicago, that is a recognition of how he saw that ship he describes, We Are the Ship, that included Latinos on that ship.
All right. Yeah. So it's interesting. Building upon that's a big thing with historians, you know, building upon previous work people have done. So I know a lot of listeners are, you know, understandably just lay folks when it comes to historical research. But yeah. if someone ever tells you like they've written the book on a subject, it's like, not quite. You've written an important book, but you're always building on what other people have done. I'm doing it. You've done it. So that's a big thing with historians. And you've already touched upon this with your first answer there. But could you describe a little bit more about what particularly got you interested in the history of baseball and race and how they connect with each other?
So I grew up a baseball fan, but I inherited that love of baseball from my mom and my grandmothers. I didn't know my grandfathers. And the way I love to describe it is my dad likes baseball. My mom loves baseball. And that passion for the game was very much part of our family history. And in ways I didn't quite know it until I was a full grown adult. And one example of this was after I had finished writing and doing all the edits, copy edits for Playing America's Game, I sent it back to the publisher. It's off to the presses. I went down to Georgia where my parents live. And one of my uncles traveled up from Sarasota, Florida. His name is Jose Antonio Burgos. And so me, that history professor, PhD, first one in the family, it's like, hey, we call him Antonio, short for Antonio. Antonio, did you know there was a player in the Negro Leagues who had the name Jose Antonio Burgos? He also played shortstop for the Ponce team in the Puerto Rican Winter League. He's like, smiles. Yeah, did you know your grandmother named me after him? That was one of her favorite players. My mind was blown. Now, what's fascinating about that is this same uncle, one of my favorite childhood memories with him was when we were living in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I was a teenager, of him coming down and I'm tossing the ball back and forth with him. And he would quiz me on who was the first Latino or Puerto Rican player on this team, who was the first Latino on that team. And I would know these things. What I didn't have an understanding of and a history of was Latinos in the Negro Leagues. And so to me, it wasn't really until college, as I was beginning to do research for my senior's thesis on baseball's introduction to the Caribbean, that it began to kind of rise to this to the top of my mind, the significance of the Negro Leagues to the Latino baseball story. This is Satchel Paige coming to the Dominican Republic, coming to Puerto Rico, going to Venezuela. It's Josh Gibson, Satchel Paige, sitting in the backyard of Perucho Cepeda's house. That's Pedro Cepeda, the father of Orlando Cepeda. And years later, I would be able to interview Orlando, and he shared these fond memories of having Negro League greats at the barbecue, the roasting of pig out in the backyard, and they're just sharing time together. And that's one of his like fondest childhood memories. And for me, what became fascinating is how come we Latinos, we Puerto Ricans and other Latinos know the story of Irán Bithorn. We know the story of Roberto Clemente and didn't know or talk openly about the history of Latinos in the Negro Leagues, because it is in fact the history of trying to deal with the color line in U.S. professional baseball with racial exclusion, and the fact that in our mixture, in our culture, the African diaspora, both in person and in culture, is profoundly evident, but we often shield it from view, from how we talk about it, how we deal with it. And that is really what got me fascinated in the history of race in baseball, how in Cuba, the professional league was integrated and the amateur leagues were not. They were racially exclusive. The Afro-Cubans were kept out of the college baseball ranks in Cuba prior to Castro's era when there was professional baseball. And, you know, like, how does race come into this question? When does it drop out? Why does it matter? How it matters? Interviewing Latinos who played in the Negro Leagues were just so illuminating about how they dealt with the reality of race in the United States, their own understanding of race and how that evolves. And then even later players, Felipe Alou is a great example of this, how he really came to embrace his Afro-Dominican, his Black identity. Once he came in the United States, he dealt with the reality of race in the Evangeline League when he went to Louisiana and they wouldn't let him play. And he understood himself more and more that I am a Black Latino. And that is who I am. And of course, Clemente was always spoke about being Black and Puerto Rican, and you know, mentioned that he had two strikes against him. So what of those guys in the Negro Leagues? And that ultimately became, man, I got to do more research on this. There's nobody who's really kind of focused discussion of the presence of Latinos in the Negro Leagues and why it really can impact how we think about the color line in baseball and the history of Latino.
Yeah, that's a very important point. You know, try to make it, I guess more real world for listeners. You know, if you think about how you fill out, you know, documents, you know, they ask you, what's your race? Then there's the ethnicity. So you can be White, Black, Native American, but you can also be White, Black, Native American, and Hispanic or Latino. So, that two strikes thing Clemente brought up, you know, that can definitely apply. And that takes us, you know, to the next question I have for you is, since, you know, Latino players could be, you know, White and Latino or Black and Latino or Native and Latino, how was the color line then applied to them? I imagine it was, I guess, a little more permeable than it was for Black players back in that era.
Yeah, and this is like the core of my first book, Playing America's Game, is studying that question. How is the color line applied to Latinos? In the research and drawing on the work of Larry Lester and Dick Clark and Jim Riley and early pioneers John Holloway on Negro League research, we know that there was about 240 or even perhaps more Latinos that played in the Black baseball circuit going back to like the 1900s, all the way through the time of 1950s. During that same time, there was 52 or 53 Latinos that played in the major leagues. In MLB, not major leagues, in MLB. Now, what's interesting to me, that's over a 4-to-1 ratio. And in fact, a number of those players, I think it was 12, played in the Black baseball circuit and then gravitated, crossed the color line and played Major League Baseball, MLB. And this is what, like, okay, what's going on here? And as I argue in the book, one of the important things to understand is this is how race is constructed in professional baseball. The owners, team officials, journalists inside that Major League Baseball world, MLB, they created categories so that they would permit certain light-skinned Latinos into the league and excluded the overwhelming majority of Latinos. It was never based purely on talent who got to play MLB prior to Jackie Robinson. If you were Latino, you had to pass the paper bag test, you had to pass the ethnicity test, you had to pass the class. The first couple of Latinos who really made it big in MLB, Rafael Almeida and Armando Marsans, they played with the Cincinnati Reds in 1911, and both of them came from very well-off backgrounds. And Marsans in particular knew his worth as a ball player and even held out. He's one of the guys who goes to the Federal League because he's like, yeah, I'm paying me what I'm owed. On the flip side of that, one of the front office officials for the Cincinnati Reds says, we did not hire a pair of dark-skinned Islanders to pay this Honus Wagner money. So yes, some Latinos got in, but still that reality of race was there. On the other side of the color line was the overwhelming talent. That is where Jose Mendez played. That is where Cristobal Torriente played. That is where Alex Pompez started his Negro League club that he called the Cuban Stars and evolved into the New York Cubans. The front office, the on-the-field, the managerial experience that Latinos were really getting when they came to the United States was in the Negro Leagues. And again, going back and forth, how did that work? What was their experience about? That's what I explore in Playing America's Game, and even more so in the second book I wrote, Cuban Star, How One Negro League Owner Changed the Face of Baseball. Because this, again, blows my mind. I'm doing research on my first book, and this name, I go to the Schomburg in Harlem, and I'm doing research, and Alex Pompez's name keeps popping up. He's on the front page because he's a numbers runner. He becomes a numbers banker. He's in the society pages because he's invited to all the big, not all, but quite a few of the big shindigs in Harlem World. And he's on the sports pages because of his Negro League baseball team. But also he ran Dykeman Oval, and that's where Fritz Pollard and his Negro League football team was playing at Dykeman Oval in 1935 and 36. boxing matches. Sisto Escobar, some of his first, this first Puerto Rican world champion boxer. Some of his earliest fights were at Dykeman Oval. Dykeman Oval was described in the Amsterdam News and New York Age as the recreation center of Harlem. Even though it wasn't physically located in Harlem, it was the place where African-Americans and other people from throughout the African diaspora that called New York City home and surrounding areas home, they went to Dykeman to sometimes have a few drinks once Prohibition was over, sometimes even during Prohibition, and also to watch baseball, football, boxing, to recreate and enjoy a world that they made possible. And, you know, this is the world of Black baseball. This is a world that wasn't one ethnicity. It was African-American. It was Afro-Cuban, Puerto Rican, Dominican, Barbudan, Barbadian. Like, you had people from throughout the West Indies who remade themselves and, you know, really made Harlem a Black Mecca. And, you know, made Chicago another Black Mecca. And, you know, this is the world of Black baseball. And that's what so fascinated me in thinking about race in baseball. Because for African-Americans and other people throughout the diaspora within the Americas, baseball provided a place that, as my one of my mentors, Earl Lewis, labeled it, to create congregation, a space of their own. Here it was multilingual. The music of jazz the music of Afro-Cuban jazz suddenly also had English lyrics to go with it, because the band that Satchmo was beginning to put together and Dizzy was being put together and Cab Calloway and Mario Bauzal, like, it was a mixture of all these worlds because it was their world. And that's what fascinated me about the Negro League story, because it was a story of creating, making congregation despite or because of segregation. And that's where baseball was such an important story.
Yeah, I love the example of the music you bring up, because, you know, I grew up in Texas. And so obviously a state where there's very much an intermixing of culture between, I mean, we can call it the dominant, you know, white people in Texas aren't necessarily white. They're, you know, they're called Anglos first, because like that just kind of sets the table that there's definitely like a Hispanic, like a Spanish speaking, and then there's the English speaking people, but then there's also Black people in the state. So Texas definitely has like this, almost like this crucible of clashing of cultures. So not clashing necessarily, but intermixing. And so it sounds like New York in that era had that going on as well. But the music, to get back to that, this idea of having, you know, this jazz incorporate Afro-Cuban rhythms and introducing English lyrics into Spanish music. And that, I think that perfectly leads to what I want to get to next, is just how did Black and Latino players, how did they, I guess, merge or fuse into Negro Leagues? You know, whether it's playing style or how did they interact on the road or on the field? Just, you know, what was life like for them playing as teammates or playing against each other in that world?
Yeah, particularly for Latino players, you know, the cultural adjustment of playing in the United States needed the friends, the help of African-Americans to help guide them. Every now and then they would come across someone like Alex Pompez, who was a U.S.-born Latino, who was Afro-Cuban-American, who understood both worlds and kind of and his whole life was navigating those worlds. There weren't too many U.S.-born Latinos that played in the Negro Leagues as there was coming out of Cuba or out of Puerto Rico, or out of Dominican. Part of that was based on the migration patterns. They hadn't come to full flourish. That the great migration of Puerto Ricans would happen during World War II and during the 1950s. And you know, with Cuban migrations, actually a lot of them were late 19th century, early 20th century, and it was mostly Key West and Tampa, Florida. Gilbert Arenas, his great uncle played in the Negro League, because his name is Gilberto Arenas, not Gil Arenas. And so he's Afro-Cuban from, part of his family's Afro-Cuban from Tampa. Alex Pompez grew up in Tampa. He was born in Key West, but grew up in Tampa. There was a vital space in Ybor City and West Tampa for Afro-Cubans there. It's interesting because the Latino players, just like any baseball team, there would be points of tension that between ball players, African Americans and Latinos. There were points of cultural misunderstandings because the awareness of each other's cultures and how that worked was evolving. Now, the other part of this story that's so vitally important is there was a Jim Crow baseball circuit and world. And what I mean by that is the better African-American players, the more talented African-American players would head south to the Caribbean, to Latin America for the winter. And often it was on the word of that Latino pitcher on the team who's like, oh, you really need to bring this shortstop down, Jimmy Crutchfield. He's great. He's a baller. We got to bring him down to play in Puerto Rico or Venezuela. And opportunities in one place helped to create opportunities in another. So as friendships developed or friendly rivalries develop, you know, a player on the New York Cubans might say, oh, you got to get that guy from Newark Eagles. You know, they're painting our side while we're playing in the Negro Leagues. But Monty Irvin, he is someone we need to have playing in Puerto Rico. And so the owners of teams in Puerto Rico, in Cuba, in Dominican Republic, relied on that talent and that experience in one place to impact the other. That helps produce opportunity. A number of these players, like Dick Say, would marry a Puerto Rican woman and actually end up living in Puerto Rico. What's his name? Great outfielder. Oh, Wild Bill Wright would play with the Baltimore Elite Giants for many years, went play in Mexico and married a Mexican woman and actually ends up living down there the rest of his days. What's, again, is interesting is in this instance, the creation of the league by Jorge Pasquel in Mexico that played as a summer league that was a rival in terms of calendar season to the Negro Leagues, he went after top flight Negro League talent, brought the African-American players down, brought Latinos out of the Negro Leagues and out of MLB to play in his league, and then went after white American players to play in his league. The experience in Latin America and in the Caribbean for African-American players was one that helped them to reaffirm their value because they were played on the basis of their talent, not on the basis of their race. They could earn so much more in a couple of months in Latin America than what they might earn during a full season in the Negro Leagues because they were being paid on how well they played, not like the scale of how it really mattered. They didn't have to play 5, 6, 7, 8 games a week like they often did in the Negro Leagues, where they were playing 4 league games, but in between they're playing exhibition games so that they could have the money to run the operations as a whole. And so that experience was really important. Yeah, there were friction at times. You had guys who, you know, had fancied the same woman, and sometimes there would be those rivalries. Other rivalries that naturally develop on the field. You know, I don't like you because you keep striking me out. Those things happen both ways. And that's the other element of that, though, I think, was there was a brotherhood that emerges out of the reality of facing Jim Crow, of dealing with Jim Crow. Armando Vasquez, who played with the Indianapolis Clowns, played with the Cubans, Afro-Cuban player, shared with me, and it shared many people in an oral interview. I was talking with him about driving through the South and how in the United States, sometimes he would go in to the restaurant and order the food. And at first they were like, oh yeah, we don't serve Negroes. And he's like, ¿qué? ¿Qué dices? I said, oh, all of a sudden he said, I transformed from a black man to something different, a foreigner. And then they're like, oh, we'll serve you. I guess they're like, you don't know any better.
Yeah, well, yeah, you don't know any better. You don't know the rules around
like,
here.
So I'll take 10 chicken sandwich, 12 fries. You know, he would order for the whole team and then bring the whole food out to the bus and they would all eat. They shared the knowledge of how race mattered in different parts in the United States, mattered in different places, even in Philadelphia, in New York, in Chicago, in Detroit, in Memphis. So they would understand and protect each other from the slights of Jim Crow, from the impact of Jim Crow. And that, I think, is really another aspect of the experience of what was going on in the Negro Leagues that didn't quite work the same way for those handful of Latinos who got into MLB. You know, many of their teammates were not what today we call allies. They were, you know, at most like, we have to play with this guy because the owner forced us. That was the experience of Roberto Estrella and many of the Cuban players that played on the Washington Senators. They were tolerated, but not in a positive sense.
Not accepted, but tolerated. Yeah, and it sounds like as you're discussing it in the Negro Leagues, the Black players were, as you're saying, you know, not always, because of course there's always personal frictions and that kind of stuff. The little tit for tat, you still have that today in sports. But it sounds like much more often than not, there was an acceptance of just the concept of having Latino players in the Negro Leagues.
Yeah, there was absolutely acceptance because they knew that it was typically the top flight talent coming from the Caribbean up to play. If the Martin brothers are bringing you to play for the Memphis Red Sox from out of the Caribbean, you're good. You know, we're only bringing you up here because you're good. You're good enough. You're above the bar of talent. Similarly, that shared experience, and it is so important because as African-Americans helped the Latino players as they traveled throughout the United States playing in the Negro Leagues, when they went to Cuba, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, to Venezuela, to Mexico, the community, the Latino players welcomed them. Again, I can't stress enough the different experience it was for Latino players in the Negro Leagues and in the African-American communities they moved within the Black communities they moved within in the United States, of being welcomed versus when they went into MLB, those communities didn't fully welcome the Latino players because they didn't see common cause beyond the playing field. You know, if you're a Black man, and even if you're a brown man, you were dealing with Jim Crow. Like you said, you come from Texas, and they had in Texas, in plenty of places, no N-word, no Mexican, no dogs allowed.
Yep.
You know, it was very clear the association between the Black man and the brown man or woman, and you know, and even animals. You know, they were all put in the same category, and so the ways in which that Negro League experience shaped the world of Jim Crow and kind of created other spaces that African-Americans and Latinos were creating for themselves. That is the history of Negro Leagues. As I mentioned before, that's the history of music. That's the history of community. And yeah, there was, you know, sometimes intermarriage. You know, it's interesting. If you look at the names of some of the women that Satchel Paige married, there was a couple of Latinas in there.
Sorry, I love that. Like some of the women Satchel Paige married. It's like, okay, we know there's a long list of whatever. They're just a list. But sometimes happens to the wealthy and famous. But actually, what you're describing actually got me, this is good, got me off my prepared questions. I thought of something interesting if you're talking about this kind of cooperative that was going on. So I know, generally speaking, it sounds like so far you're talking about an era that's, you know, 1920s through 1940s. But through your research, have you been able to detail any sort of lasting impact in terms of, any of these people working toward, what we would call the civil rights movement? Maybe they didn't call it that at that point, like in the late 40s or so. Whether it was the players or maybe even owners of these teams, they use this as like a springboard toward pushing for civil rights in society.
Well, again, Roberto Clemente is a powerful example of using the traditions of being Afro-Puerto Rican, the struggles that were inherent to that on the island of Puerto Rico, and how much his experience in Pittsburgh playing in the United States reiterated that reality of being a Black man in the United States. And he was very vocal about that in different ways. One of the things that I wanted to mention, because I talk about in Cuban Star, was how players, particularly in the Negro Leagues, as Major League Baseball, MLB, began to undertake the project of desegregating. There were, that generation of Monty Irving and other players mentored the next generation. And Monty was very much about not just the politics of respectability, but the politics of being responsible to your community, of helping the next generation, but also being involved. Effa Manley is partly in the National Baseball Hall of Fame, part as the first woman elected, because she saw baseball and Black baseball being absolutely intertwined with the cause for civil rights and justice. And she was raising civil war bonds and helping raise funds for the NAACP at the ballpark. And that those things were inextricably linked, that you had to see that as one world, one experience. And so you had players, you had Latino players who saw the example that Effa Manley set, and then other owners. And this is why Effa Manley is in the Hall of Fame, because she affected other owners. Alex Pompez also had drives, not just for the war, but about raising funds for the NAACP or other community organization to help African-Americans and other people of color in their quest for civil rights and justice in the United States. It is a culture that was in the streets, it was in the community, and it was affecting what was going on. And Effa Manley was, I would argue, the best at bringing that to the ballpark. And other owners felt that and recognized and respected that and said, yeah, we got to do that too. Other owners in the Negro Leagues did that as well. Into the realm, and so part of what I'm saying is there's this culture that race and sports and politics do mix, because that is the reason for Black baseball, because race and politics were already mixing with sports. Now you got me on one of my tangents. See, one of the things that as a historian annoys me is this notion about race and politics and sports don't mix. The only reason for a color line in professional sports was the mixing of race and politics with sport. Otherwise, you wouldn't have no color line.
Yeah, exactly. If you're just playing baseball, then everybody would be playing baseball together.
And so when people start preaching civil rights at the ballpark and start organizing for it, an athlete takes a knee, it's not the introduction of politics, it's really the recognition of politics already there. You know, Cap was not the first person to make a pronouncement. The presence of Jackie Robinson in MLB was because of the pressure that civil rights organizations were putting on Major League Baseball, MLB. Branch Rickey might have waved it off and said, no, I was doing it because it's the right thing. And when I was a coach back in college and Charlie Thomas was discriminated, I vowed one day I'm going to right this wrong. It was not the journey of one man to rectify. It took the courage of Branch Rickey for sure. But it was not the journey of one man. There was a whole community or sets of communities that were fighting for integration, and not just the integration that Branch Rickey and the 15 owners who voted against Branch Rickey implemented. They had their, Effa Manley, Alex Pompez, Gus Greenlee, others, like they had been advocating for their own integration of Black baseball and MLB. And so it's interesting that many years later, 2020, we see Major League Baseball recognize the Negro Leagues as major leagues. They were saying this in the 1940s and bring us in together. It was the owners in Major League Baseball who said, no, we want your talent. We don't want your teams. And that was a very different version of integration. That is a long way of answering. The vision of integration was a civil rights issue. And the advocates of integration came from all the African-American community, the Afro-Latino community, the Latino community, because they wanted to change game and the society in which it was played. They wanted fairness, equity, opportunity to really be what structured the reality of life in these communities. And in many ways, that's why Clemente was always vocal. That's why Felipe Alou writes, you know, the Latin American player needs a Bill of Rights, that we need to recognize how there are structured inequalities that, in particularly in professional baseball, were the product of segregation. You know, playing the game the right way was a product of segregation. And when Major League Baseball did not have Black folk, this is the way they played it. But they're not going to say that. They say, oh, he doesn't play the game the right way. Yeah. Jackie Robinson, I'm always entertained by how people celebrate Jackie Robinson and don't go back to how his story of arrival and playing in 1947 and beyond was covered by the press. Because there are plenty of journalists, sports writers who pointed to Jackie Robinson dancing off first base, creating a box saying, that's not how the game is played. That's disrespectful to the game. He's causing he's making these guys nervous and he's making them, it's like, that's baseball. That's Black baseball. That was Caribbean baseball. That's the way the game was played. Just because you came into this orthodoxy of how the game is supposed to be played. It was the same thing when you had Vic Power with the one hand stretch at first base. And they're like, that's not how you play the game. You're supposed to become anchored and have your two hands out and catch the ball with two hands at first base. And then they start seeing how Vic Power is catching, you know, that fluid motion and gold glove playing first base. When Omar Vizquel starts catching the ball on the outside of the glove, it's like, that's not how you play the game. You know, the swim move, when Javier Baez is doing the swim move and sliding in, people are like, no, that's not. Oh, wait, he's safe. Oh, wait, he's safe. And now you see all these other players constantly. Mike Trout is doing the swim move. Mike didn't think of that on his own. He's like, man, if it works for Javier, it's going to work for me.
Yeah, it's not the right way to play until it works.
Players change the game.
Yeah. Yeah, not the right way to play until it works. And then everybody
and how you coach him.
Oh. Well, I guess you've already started touching upon this, actually quite a bit, but the last question I want to kind of leave you on is, personally, I think many historians think this way, at least I hope they do. Personally, I think that the study of history is only important as it relates to how people live their life today and how we're going to do things going forward. So I'd like for you to, you know, explain to listeners, in your opinion, why do you think it's important for them to know this history of Black baseball, Latino baseball in that era? You know, what relevance does it have for our lives today? Specific to baseball, maybe, or even just society at large?
So I'm going to put on my professor cap real quick, you know, put my baseball historian.
Yes, go ahead.
Off to the side. He passed away, a brilliant Haitian scholar named Michel Ralph Trouillot. He was an anthropologist by training, but he wrote this book called Silencing the Past. And in it, I read the most profound description of history. He wrote, history is a relationship between those of us in the present and the past. And so if we accept, and I do, Trouillot's understanding of history, history never dies. It's always living in the present because it's how we relate to everything that happened before and how we understand what happened before. Why it's important to understand the history of the Negro Leagues and the presence of Latinos in the Negro Leagues is to understand how race has mattered, how there are ways, if we don't attend to the reality of race in U.S. life, in Caribbean life, structures of inequality will become built by saying, oh yeah, these things don't matter. These things don't matter. There's a difference between things shouldn't matter and that they do matter. It's a huge gulf. And by not attending to the realities of, we see it right now in Major League Baseball, in MLB. Why are there so few African-American players in MLB? Because the apparatus of Black baseball, the pipeline that brought players from the community to Black colleges and universities and the Negro Leagues, when Major League Baseball pursued integration, they did not reinvest, maintain the Black baseball infrastructure. There was a couple of quirks. That is, Alex Montez being hired by the New York Giants and eventually San Francisco Giants to be, and becoming their director of international scouting. Alex Bump has brought in players from Cuba, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Alabama, Texas. He brought Willie Kirkland. He helped the Giants get Willie Mays. He had Willie McCovey from Mobile, Alabama. The expertise of Alex Bump and Buck O'Neill that was honed in the Negro Leagues was brought into the scouting operations of the Cubs and of the Giants. A couple of teams did that. The vast majority said, we're going to scout black players the same way we scout white players, except a bit racist about it. So when you go watch, Willie Mays as a scout for the Boston Red Sox, it rains. I'm not hanging another day to watch this black player. He didn't use black player play. I'm leaving. He doesn't even scout Willie. He just leaves. If that was Mickey Mantle, I guarantee you he would have stayed in Commerce, Oklahoma another day to watch him play. This is how race was significant in the world of baseball. And so to understand that if we say, oh no, all the talent was scouted the same way, you're missing that they were scouting black and Latino talent who were dealing with discrimination in all aspects of their lives in a way that didn't recognize the reality of opportunity that these players had and that their ability to overcome it. Alex Bumpez, Latino ball players were constantly saying, we need bilingual staff on major league teams. This is what Felipe Alou was saying in 1963 when he wrote the article. This is what other guys were saying earlier. We need multilingual staff in MLB teams. If you're going to bring the talent from Latin America and elsewhere, your coaching staff, your front office staff should be able to help these players acclimate. Not, just let them out on their own. So back to the black baseball infrastructure, they assumed that every African-American athlete would want to be Jackie Robinson. Not understanding or not fully embracing the reality, look at what Jackie Robinson and his family went through. Mack Robinson, when we look at the 1936 Olympics, we're watching Jesse Owens winning. And Jesse wins that next gold medal. And over his shoulder, right on his shoulder, is Mack Robinson, silver medalist. What was Mack Robinson doing when he got back to Pasadena? He was a sanitation worker because there was no other opportunities for this Olympic level athlete who had an education than to be a sanitation worker. I'm not disparaging sanitation workers. I'm disparaging the opportunities presented to a black man of that education, of that quality, to that those particular professions. And if we don't understand how today African-American opportunities, travel baseball, well, if you can afford it, you play. Mm-hmm. Most African-Americans who, athletes or families who are interested in this can't afford travel baseball. By the time from 10 to 18 years old, think about how much money a family has spent on travel baseball for just one kid. Nevertheless, if they have two kids, three kids, or four kids, are you able to invest $80,000 to $200,000 in expenses for the play, for the travel, for the hotel stays? But then there's basketball and there's football. Or how important is travel football to the world? Barely important at all. Because it's subsidized. It's in high school football. That's the pipeline. So Major League Baseball did not tend to that pipeline. And we even had guys like Bob Gibson go to Creighton and play basketball and baseball, go with the Harlem Globetrotters before he went into Major League Baseball. That generation, and it wasn't in the 60s, it was really in the 70s and 80s where we saw African-American talent migrate to other sports and opportunities. Baseball blew it then. How do you recover? You got to invest in it. They invested the heck out of the Dominican Republic. And I love it. I mean, to see Juan Soto play, that's great. But if you want John Sutton coming out of South Side, North Side of Philly, South Side of Chicago, you got to invest. You got to pay money to get that African-American youth playing baseball, getting coached. I mean, MLB loves to see John Young build RBI baseball, to see the Lou Colliers of the world build baseball on the South Side and have his own travel team. There are some major league teams, I shout out to the Chicago White Sox, that invest in black communities and in travel baseball to create opportunities. All MLB teams should be doing that as an investment in its own future and in fandom. Because you want more African-Americans interested? Invest in their community, and you'll see the LeBron of baseball playing again alongside a Javier Baez. Like, that's how it's done. But that is why this history is relevant. Because if you don't study how Major League Baseball pursued the incorporation of Black talent from African-American communities and the Dominican and Cuba and Puerto Rico, then you fail to see how they built or bilked the Black baseball infrastructure to make the quick fix of their league, get Willie Mays for $15,000, mm-hmm. when he was worth at least $150,000. And that is what creates that infrastructure to disintegrate. And yeah, this is why the history is so important. You understand every Negro League team had a Black or Latino manager. Like, think about that. Yep. When think on that level, and then you have to wait till Jackie Robinson is dead and his last public appearance is really telling MLB in 1971, I'll be most proud when I can look down the third baseline and see a Black man in a managerial seat. We still had to wait a couple of years before Frank Robinson is hired by Cleveland. Every Negro League team had a Black or Latino manager. Jose Mendez, Afro-Cuban, was a manager of the Kansas City Monarchs during his height in the 1920s. Afro-Cuban manager of the New York Yankees variant of the Negro Leagues. 1920s. Like, this is what's mind-blowing when we think about the opportunities that Black men and women had in Major League Baseball as it was, quote, integrating. Yep. From the press box to on the field to the front office. It's like, no, we just want you on the field. That's it. That's a prescription for failure.
But Professor Burgos, thank you for sharing with us the history of Latino players in the Negro Leagues, and also I think a really thoughtful and just interesting, I think, for a lot of listeners. Might be the first time they've contemplated just how race relations work beyond just Black and white, how Black and Latino can work together. And then, you know, how those two groups then have to work alongside a white power structure. So it's a complex but important history, and I'm glad you're able to help us tease out just a part of it. This is just baseball. There are many other facets of American society where similar stuff happened, but this is just baseball. That's what we're able to cover. Thank you again, Professor Burgos, for helping us out here.
Thanks for having me on, Curtis. I really enjoyed our time.
All right, and that does it for this episode of The Negro Leagues Are Major Leagues. I'd like to again express my appreciation for Professor Adrian Burgos for joining us today on the podcast. And I hope you all who are listening to this learned quite a bit. I know I did from Professor Burgos. And I hope to see you back for the next episode of The Negro Leagues Are Major Leagues.